House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. Game changed.
Hello and welcome to House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. I'm Eimear Considine and I'm joined in studio by Fergus McFadden. We will be joined very soon by Springbok star and 2019 World Player of the Year, Peter Steph Dutoit, and we are very excited to chat to him. But we really do have to start off with the Pro 14 and those two gripping interpros on Friday and Saturday night. Ulster and Connacht both had brilliant starts in their respective games, but Leinster and Munster got the job done and will meet in a league final for the first time since 2011 at the end of this month. Starting on that Ulster game, Ulster 19, Leinster 38. Ulster had a superb start, tries from Marcel Coetzee and Robert Balakoon. Then a second yellow card for Leinster. Fergus, what was your take on Frank Murphy's yellow cards for Devon Toner and then Jimmy O'Brien?
Yeah, well, I think the yellow for Dev with the high tackle, that was only a yellow, you know. He's such a tall man, and in fairness, Michael Larry, he's kind of dipping there, and you know, he didn't really, thankfully, catch him too high either. Yeah. It was just around over his shoulder. So yeah, it was a tough period for Leinster because Ulster really did start well. They threw the ball around. It was a nice day up there, and they really stretched Leinster's defence. But I thought Leinster hung in there when we went down to 14, and then, you know, almost even better when we went down to 13. I think Ulster probably kicked away the ball a couple of times when they could have held on to it, because the key against 13 players is holding on to it for as many phases as possible. And yeah, the Jimmy O'Brien one was, you know, you could be disappointed if you're an Ulster supporter. I'm sure a lot of the Ulster players were. I could see Geordie Murphy was very frustrated as a captain there. There was absolutely no intent from Jimmy O'Brien, as, you know, Mads was jumping for the ball coming in. It was happening very quickly, but head-on-head contact, you could argue that it was probably a red card. So he's probably lucky to get away with the yellow, but still, I think Leinster showed their class by managing that period so well and you know, not conceding too many tries during that period.
They absolutely did. And then obviously they scored through Michael Bent, and then Josh Vanderfleer's powered over the line after that. So Leinster really just showed their dominance and like the patience and calmness to come back and bring it back in. But obviously Stuart McCluskey was then yellow carded, which didn't help Ulster's case.
Yeah, I think stuff like that was just, I'd say Ulster fans, you know, in their houses were putting their chairs through the TV, because it seemed like a lot of decisions were just falling Leinster's way. But I think the reality of the game and the way the game unfolded, if you take the cards out of it, I think Leinster were just, you know, over the course of 80 minutes were so much more clinical. I think, you know, Ulster started really brilliantly, yeah, but this Leinster team, it, you know, it only really gets going, you know, come the 60th minute, and then it can unload its bench. And I think that the bench yesterday probably showed up what Ulster had on their bench. I think Leinster just went to another gear when that happened. And I think frustrating for Ulster, though, because the scoreline definitely didn't reflect the game. Like, I don't think Leinster deserved by as much to win by as much as they did, particularly after another tricky decision with Balakoon, that second try that he scored.
What getting ruled out. What do you think about that? The running line that he was it blocking? Was it a close one? It was a great try.
Oh, it was an unbelievable finish. And I think Mads had said on the show a couple of weeks ago that he is a talent to look out for, and he's electric. He looks like he's recovered pretty well from that hamstring injury. I do think it was probably a penalty, to be honest, because if you are a decoy runner, but the person getting the ball in behind you has to run around you, it's very difficult for the defender in front of that decoy runner to get past him and hit the guy who's actually getting the ball. So you could see there that Rhys Ruddock's eye line was just cut off by Stuart McCluskey, and then Balakoon ran around the back. So I think it was probably the right decision by Frank Murphy.
Yeah, he was. Frank Murphy was the man of the moment last night anyway, with, I suppose, the decisions that he made. And another controversial decision that, you know, people can look one or the other way at it, it was the red card on Warwick for his forearm to the neck of Ed Byrne. What did you make of that one? red card or not?
Again, I think letter of the law, it's a red card. I thought, again, it's harsh, though. Like, I don't think there's any intent from him. And, you know, thankfully, Ed Byrne wasn't hurt, but it kind of caught him on the neck as opposed to the face. But just very sensitive these days. You know, I think with all of the headlines the last couple of months around concussions and the implications it's had for some people, unfortunately, that it's a very, very sensitive topic now. And I think that these regulations have been brought in for good reason. And I think the refs aren't going to get every decision right, but I think if the duty of care is and the players, you know, health and safety is at the best interests are at heart, then it's for the best of the game, I think.
Yeah, I suppose, 26 penalties awarded in the total game. So he was definitely busy last night. 4 yellow cards and 1 red card. Have Ulster fans a right to feel hard done by? It was a very stop-start game as a result of the amount of penalties given away.
Yeah, but I think the old saying goes, if you know, the best refs are the ones that you barely even realise that they're there, because the game generally flows a lot better. But in saying that, it depends what's happening in a match. It can't be a free-for-all either. But I do think that an awful lot of things were being checked, and it probably stopped both Ulster and Leinster getting into a real flow in the game. Some tough decisions there for Frank Murphy, but I suppose when everyone's after an inter-provincial or a really big match, when everyone's talking about the ref the next day, it's probably never the best sign.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on to the Munster-Connacht game then. Connacht were already outsiders to reach their second final in 5 years, but they gave Munster a scare for an hour or so until Mike Haley produced a superb solo try. Paul Boyle gave Connacht hope, but a Joey Carberry penalty sealed their first final appearance since 2017. Some try, wasn't it, by Mike Haley?
That was a brilliant, brilliant try. Brilliant individual try. A beautiful chip with his left foot. He's a right-footed player, and it was just lovely weight, and it was one of those ones that it just popped up for him. But he had a brilliant game in general. I think Connacht did kick a bit loosely to him at times, and he made them pay for that. And yeah, that was just brilliant. It changed the game, really, and probably won it for Munster, so fair play to him.
It's always awful, isn't it, when something like that happens? Great for the attacking team, killer for the defensive team when it comes totally out of nowhere. You know, there was no phases built. It just was a gap, unbelievable line and unbelievable chip through. But it does some amazing things for teams and boosts them. And obviously Munster got such a boost off that.
Yeah, I think in those tight games and those interprovincial derbies, they can just be, the margins are so small that it can just take a moment of brilliance like that, individual brilliance that actually separates the sides at the end of the day. And yeah, Mike Haley's moment was probably the one that won it for Munster.
I saw Bundy Aki was absolutely kicking himself at the very end of that game, giving away a penalty straight in front of post. Like, that's just something that you cannot be doing.
Yeah, I mean, he probably felt the ball was out because he kind of tried to counter-ruck, or he picked the ball up and he felt it was out. And unfortunately for Connacht, he got penalised, and Joey had just come on the field and he knocked over the kick. So fair play to him. But yeah, he will be kicking himself. But, you know, between Mike Haley's, you know, break and the way he scored that try, you know, in the balance of things, I think Munster just about deserved to win it.
So Mike Haley and that moment of brilliance, you know, it always spurs teams on. Was there any player or any moment of your playing career where someone just did something phenomenal that, like, the team really needed at that moment?
Yeah, well, I think when you're playing with the likes of, you know, Brian O'Driscoll and Gordon Darcy for a number of years, they produce some magic moments. But one that sticks out in my head is probably quarter-final we played against Leicester in 2011 in the Heineken Cup. Eason Asewa got the ball off a loose kick around the halfway line, and he made this break and dummied like three players and just ghosted by those guys. It was one of those ones where people were falling over, he was sidestepping, and just a magical, incredible individual effort from him, and I'll never forget it. So yeah, when you've people like that in your team that can do that stuff. But I think, in fairness, you know, all the four provinces do have people like that as well, and it's just about a certain scenario opening for them. Like, remember Jordan Larmer's brilliant try against Munster when he, you know, sidestepped five players and managed to have the gas to get in the corner. So, those ones would stick out to mind for me.
Yeah, there's so many moments as well in the women's game. Even like Ali Miller was a winger that was just phenomenal. I don't know how many tries she scored for Ireland, but they just came out of nowhere at moments when you needed them. Obviously, her try, her famous, most famous try, is that World Cup try where Ireland beat New Zealand for the first time in that World Cup to get them to the semi-final spot. Kind of came out of nowhere. Again, similarly, it was Briggsy that claimed a kick, a loose kick, and then set her, put her away. It took a lot of work to do, but phenomenal score. And even in that last year's Six Nations, we'd been pinned in our 22 for a good 20 minutes against Wales, and again a loose kick went up to the Welsh 15, didn't deal with it very well, ended up kicking it against a gale force wind. Bavin Parsons got it, stepped how many players, and just finished to try out a nowhere, and it came from nothing, but it just gives teams such spirit and such hope to go on when you can get something from nothing. It's such an inspiration.
Yeah, sometimes you just need, when, say for instance, Ulster against Leinster, they felt probably the tide was against them with all those refereeing decisions and all the rest, and them not getting the bounce of the ball. Sometimes, maybe if they just had one or two of those moments, the result could have been an awful lot different.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, let's get Peter Steph on to chat to us from South Africa.
They will be great value. They'll be great value, and you'll be able to really buzz off them, and they will buzz off one another. And you won't be shy of laughs. Your sides will be sore from laughing. They know each other very well, and do you know what? It's just, I hope they know where to leave things, because it is a show that everyone's going to see, and it's a family show. So they can be bold, the two of them, but good value. So I'm going to tune in.
In the past 12 months, we've had Springboks legend John de Villiers, Skalk Berger and Victor Matfield all joining us on the show. Today, it is an absolute pleasure to be joined on the show by Stormers and South African forward, 2019 World Cup winner and 2019 World Rugby Player of the Year, Peter Steph Dutoit. Welcome to House of Rugby Ireland.
Thank you very much. It's a real honour for me to be here with you guys and to chat to you as well.
We're delighted to chat to you, and we're so excited about what you're going to tell us about South African rugby and the upcoming Lions tour. But just to start off, we want to start off with a gentle loosener. We've heard that your nickname when you were with the Sharks camp was the Harvester. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's quite a funny story. One of my previous teammates, Marcel Coutier, we were warming up, and I think it was 2013 probably, just pre-season or one of the warm-up games we were about to play, and warming up, and Marcel was just sitting next to the side and doing some extra stretching, and we were running forward and we had to run back as well, and he was sitting without me knowing right behind me, and I just tripped over him, and I guess that's where the nickname started. But it's not one nickname that really stuck. So I guess there's a few other that probably stuck a bit more, but like I said, it's a funny story how that one got to me.
Is it still used these days in camp or anything?
Yeah, so I guess these days it's a bit different. I've got, as you know, my name is Peter Steph, so they call me, a lot of my friends just call me Peter or Steph, or my grandfather actually had a funny nickname. He also played for the Springboks, and his nickname was, if you transfer it to English, it was Muscles, and it's in South Africa it's called Spira, and that's something that just stuck with some of the mates as well.
So you said your grandfather Peter Steph Dutoit played for the Springboks in the 1950s and 60s. He passed away when you were quite young, though, when you were about 4 or 5. Was his legacy a big part of your rugby career?
Yes, of course. I guess probably that's where the dream started for me as well. Learning what the Springboks really meant from him, and what they'd stand for as a team that stage is in that early years as well. So always when I grew up and saw some of the video clips and some of the stories he told me as well, that I can remember, but not a lot of. It's quite special for me to be part of a team like that, and always a big dream of mine. And I must say, being fortunate and humbled enough to being part of the Springbok setup at the moment or at the World Cup was unbelievable for me.
How has the last year changed? You know, obviously there's a pandemic, there's a global pandemic at the moment, but how has the last year been for you? Are you still on your family farm just outside Cape Town?
Yes, so I must say the last year for me was quite difficult. In 29th of Feb last year, I had quite a serious injury to my upper left leg called compartment syndrome, and I've been struggling with that since then, and at the moment it's going actually quite well. I must say I'm very fortunate enough that COVID came at this time. Like I said, I didn't miss a lot of rugby, especially international rugby for the Springboks, so I'm very fortunate if you look at it in that point of view. But yes, I was at the farm, and when we were at lockdown in South Africa at family farm with the rest of my family and brothers, and we really had a really enjoyable time there as well.
I hear you're the oldest of the four brothers, Peter, and I also hear that you're maybe not even the best sportsman out of all four of them. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. Like you said, I'm the oldest, and the other one also plays rugby with me for the Stormers. And then there's another one who studies medicine, and he played Varsity Cup in Stellenbosch as well. But he's almost my size, but he plays fullback, so he's actually quite a big guy. And I'd probably say he was the one guy everyone actually thought was going to make it. But like I said, he preferred studying medicine and having a different career. Probably more wise than me and my other brother. And the youngest one, yeah, he's living life and enjoying rugby, and yeah, he's just probably enjoying it the way it's probably supposed to be enjoyed and just playing it like for fun.
That's cool. It must have been the perfect environment really for all four years to have so much space in the farm, and I'm sure you were probably highly competitive in absolutely everything you did, so that must have been pretty cool growing up like that together.
Yeah, like I said, when we grew up on a farm, it was always me and my other brother that plays with me, Johan, always on one side playing against the younger two, but it was always they had to touch us and we had to tackle them. So it was a bit of an advantage for, I won't say for which team, but you can just guess. And at the end of the day, like you said, we were competitive, but it was always for the fun of it and just the joy of it. And yeah, all the funny tricks that came from that, it's really enjoyable, and it's always memories I'll always have for the rest of my life.
That's pretty cool. There's we're just doing a bit of research on you, Peter. You know, aside from your rugby prowess before, you know, the show started and all the rest, and we had heard that your father got a tendon removed from his hamstring to aid one of your knee injuries, is that right? Can you give us a bit of information around that? Because it sounds pretty crazy.
Yeah, injuries have been a part of my career and part of my life since I grew up on a farm. Like you can imagine, we were quite busy and rough on the farm, just like we are in South Africa. But yes, that's true, what you just said. In 2014, I injured my knee. I tore my ACL. I was out for 11 months and had a full recovery. Everything went well. And then in 2015, we started with the preseason and everything went really well. The Super Rugby started. And exactly a year and one day after the first injury of my knee, I tore my ACL again in Bloemfontein against the Cheetahs. And that was like, it was the 2015 World Cup year. So I really tried to push hard and play well to make the squad. And I went to see the doctor the Monday in Cape Town, and when I got there, my father actually went with me to go to the doctor. My mother normally take me, but he said, no, he'll take me this time. He left the farm for first time in a few days. And we went to the doctor, and the doctor said, yeah, it's probably ACL torn again. Need to make a plan and probably get a donor from, I can't remember the whole story where they wanted to get a tendon from, but they didn't want to take my hamstring again because I took it the first time. And of course, I was raced for time as well. And just getting another injury by harvesting another tendon is a problem as well. So my father came up with a smart idea if they can't use his one. And the doctor said, of course, let me do some research and speak with other colleagues. And yeah, the next morning, I think 2 days after that, we both went in the same hospital room, and I went in first, and the doctor cut my knee open and saw what had to be done, and yeah, they pulled him in just afterwards and harvested his tendon. And yeah, when we came to the farm, we both actually went out of the hospital in wheelchairs, and when we landed on the, when we came, my mother took us to the farm. He just got out of the car and started farming again. It was like nothing happened to him. I was on my crutches, struggling to the room, and had to lie on the bed.
Jesus, that's proper fatherly love there.
Would you do that, Ferg?
Well, I've got Peter. I've got two sons, Peter. One is 2 and 1 is 7 months. So I hope I'm the type of father that is willing to donate tendons to them if the time is right when I'm old enough.
He was very selfless for sure.
My father always makes the joke. I think I'll probably take it as a joke, but I think he's quite serious. And he always says he's still waiting for his paycheck because he never had the opportunity to become a Springbok. So now he says he's part of him becoming a Springbok and part of me as well.
Absolutely. His chance to get out on the field there. Your wife is also a physiotherapist. That must have helped with your rehab, I suppose, especially recently in the last year, you know, around your rehab after those surgeries that you had.
Yes, I must say that's probably a big thing that's in my favour at the moment. She helped me a lot during lockdown. We weren't able to go to physios or doctors or do any rehab. So that helped me really a lot in just the beginning stages. But I had a bit of a setback with the injury I had at the moment. It was a long story. I actually had to go in for a second operation again. There was some stuff that wasn't fixed properly the first time. And I must say, probably because lockdown, I probably couldn't follow up with the doctors the whole time. And that probably set me back a few days or weeks. But luckily, everything is fixed at the moment. And yeah, I must say, having a physiotherapist around is always nice and helpful.
Obviously, you come from a rugby background, a rugby family growing up in South Africa. But what's common is young guys, when they go to high school, is to go to rugby schools to develop their rugby further. But you didn't make that change. You chose to stay with your local high school, which is probably a strange decision for someone who really, you know, was breaking into that Springbok team.
Yes, of course. When I went to high school, it was my father actually put me in hostel the first semester, and it's actually only about 10 minutes drive from the farm. And I always loved the farm. It's the only place I wanted to be was on the farm after school. And when they put me in hostel, it was quite bad for me. I actually thought they hated me or I did something wrong, that they had to punish me like that. But after the first semester, they saw I didn't like it, and I was fortunate enough, they took me out of the hostel, and I drove the school bus in every day. And at night, my mother just came and fetched me when all the sports and athletics and rugby and every training, all the training was done. So I must say, that's probably a big advantage that I had, staying close to home and with my parents helping me and supporting me. I always had a good support system. So I must say that's something really counted in my favour.
So you said you played lots of other sports there growing up. You did athletics. What other sports did you play? Do you think that they contributed to your athleticism in your rugby career?
Yeah, definitely. So I loved athletics when I was in high school. I started at a very young age with athletics, and especially the track items I did on the field, on the course, it really helped me a lot in the way we trained. So I must say, our coach then, she really developed a lot of my skills and the way I run and the running style. And I guess that had a massive impact in me, the way I am today and developed, and not going to gym too early at the young stage, and gave my muscles the opportunity and my ligaments to settle quite well. But I must say, injury still took its part of my career so far.
Peter, just going to touch on the Lions tour impending, and which is due to start in the summertime. And there's been a lot of question marks over where it's going to be now, obviously because of COVID and the implications it's had on crowds and travelling. What do you think about the idea of it going ahead in the likes of an Australia, or even there was a suggestion it might happen in the UK? Because the way I look at that is, you know, from my perspective, like playing against South Africa, I never played against you in South Africa, but it's one of the most hostile places to go, and that home advantage is so huge for you guys. So to take that away, you know, what do you think about that?
Yeah, of course. I must say, we're in different times in the world. Everyone is in the same boat. It's difficult to think forward what's going to happen and what is the right thing to do going forward. But I must say, to answer your question, it's, of course, playing in South Africa is a massive home ground advantage for us. And just the passion and the honor we've got playing here, especially for the Springboks. And you almost play with your heart on your sleeve when you're in South Africa and against the Lions, because they are probably 3/4 of the stadium are filled with Lions supporters. So you don't actually have that much of a home ground advantage, only the field you're playing on. And I guess that will definitely play a big role. So for us going, say, for instance, to the UK or Australia, it's probably going to be very difficult as well. But of course, you're going to face a new challenge in South Africa. We struggled with a lot of stuff at the moment, and I guess the whole world is going through that. But yeah, playing rugby in South Africa, you always try and put your country at a better place and make the people around you proud, and your families and the supporters as well. So we'll definitely, even if we play in the UK with a full stadium filled with Lions supporters, it will definitely be a massive challenge for us, and that's one we'll definitely accept face on.
Yeah, I think the priority for everyone in the rugby world is for it just to go ahead at this stage, really. But I suppose for people listening, Peter, and you're well aware of this, you know, for Lions players that get picked on the tours, you know, it happens every 4 years, and they travel to, you know, either South Africa, Australia, or New Zealand. But for the likes of you, you know, it comes around only once in a South African's career to play against the Lions. You know, to get that honour and to get that opportunity. So it must be a massive priority for you to try get back fit again and get back to that kind of standard you were at when you won the last World Cup.
Yeah, definitely. So personally, my main goal at the moment is I don't even think about what's happening after the Lions, and everything was planned around this year and only till the end of the year, and hopefully things would have sorted out itself by then. But like we all know, it's different times, different challenges we're all facing. So yeah, like you said, every 12 years it's a massive honor to be part of that. If you're just born a year too late or too early, you won't make it. And a lot of us in South Africa planned our rugby careers around the Lions tour, and of course this pandemic came and it actually threw everything apart now. So like I said, we'll have to definitely be able to adapt and change and definitely make plans. And I guess in South Africa, that's what we have to do. We always have to make plans and thinking clearly as well.
Yeah, well, hopefully the Lions tour can go ahead and that we do see it happening at some stage this year. I suppose another proud moment, you know, obviously a proud moment of your career would be to play in that Lions tour. But another proud moment was when you were made captain of South Africa. Razzie Erasmus arrives into the scene and you're his first game as coach, you're made captain in his first test match. What was the conversation like around that? Or, you know, were you surprised or honoured or excited to be captain of the Springboks team?
Yeah, it was actually definitely a big surprise and honour for me. I think he sent me a WhatsApp and he asked me, can you phone me? And I said, yeah, of course. I think it was at night as well. And he phoned me and I answered the phone and he said, yeah, straight ahead. He just said, listen, do you want to be captain against the Wales team? It'll probably be only for one test, but yeah, I guess that's where we're going to go forward. And he thought I was the right person at that stage to captain it. And it was a massive honour for me. It's something I couldn't believe. I did cry a bit. And I think the best part of it all was when I phoned my father, and he couldn't believe it as well. The whole family was so supportive. And like I said, it's almost like a dream I never had, but it was almost too big to dream it. But yeah, I must say I'm very fortunate enough, even if it was only for one test. And yeah, even if we did lose, but it doesn't matter. It was a checklist, a tick on my side, and it's something I'm really proud of.
I suppose South Africa have had such success, and obviously topping it off with winning that 2019 World Cup. But what was the game, or what was the moment that you as a squad realised that, you know, this squad, this team are going places?
Yeah, there wasn't probably one moment when you realised this and we're going to win this World Cup. It was always a slow and steady journey for us. We didn't have 4 years like normal squads had. I think we had 2 years. And that was quite challenging for us. But I think the way everything was planned, everyone adapted, everyone bought into all the plans. And I think that's if you look back, it's actually the first day when we first had the alignment camps and started planning on for the first test match against Wales in USA. That's where it all started. And for me, that's when I really actually thought we've got something special here. We didn't even thought about, or I didn't even thought about then, okay, we've got a chance for the World Cup. But that's always in the back of your mind. You'll always dream it. You'll always believe it as well. But until we get there, and when we got there, we started seeing we've got a good opportunity. And I must say, when Rassi and the whole coaching team told us, listen, if we can beat New Zealand in New Zealand in 2018, the people will give us a good opportunity and a good chance to win the World Cup. And he was 100% right. And that's actually when the wheels started turning for us.
Rolling back the years, Peter, to a younger stage of your career, when you played in the Junior World Championships in 2012 with South Africa, when you guys actually won that competition as well. But at the start of the competition, you guys lost to Ireland in your first pool game, and Ian Henderson was on that team. He's still currently playing for Ireland, and he could well be touring to the Lions in the summer. What do you remember of that tournament, and what other South African professionals were involved in that team?
Yeah, so when we were in 2012, there was actually a lot of the young guys that still play rugby and made it in South Africa as well, and overseas teams. I can remember the first game, like you said, we played against Ireland, and we played in Stellenbosch on Donny Craven. And that's the first time I played there as well, and probably the last time as well, and I lost there. And it was a rainy day, the field was muddy, it wasn't very good conditions, and they actually moved the tournament from Donny Craven to Newlands and Greenpoint because of the field bad condition. But yeah, if you look about other guys that played there as well, you look at Paul Willems, who plays for France. There's a lot of guys in South African setup. Steven Kitsoff was there, Brom Steyn that plays for Italy. So it was really a lot of guys that made it internationally for other teams as well that played with me there. And I must say the guys that was there was really good players as well.
So as fast forward to the World Cup, you know, it's the most recent major tournament that, you know, in world rugby and always the pinnacle of rugby. And looking at England, you know, they had played so well ahead of the game. You know, what were your thoughts ahead of the game, ahead of that World Cup final? Like, what does someone think about ahead of a World Cup final?
I guess we didn't think too much. I still remember like yesterday when we beat Wales in the semi-final. Lode Jager just came to me after the game, and he probably said it to everyone, but that's something that stuck with me. We just need one chance. And when we got into the final, I mean, won Wales, we just had that confidence. There's no way we're going to lose this game. Or everything we've been through, where we came from, everyone had a special story behind them. So it was a lot of individual guys that motivated themselves, not just by the team and just the whole road they walked to get there and what we had to do. And especially, like I said again, what was going on in South Africa at that stage, the country did need a bit of positive and nice stuff to go forward. And especially when the Springboks do well, everyone in South Africa is happy. And I guess that's the same as other countries that's rugby mad as well.
Yeah, I think it kind of is more important, just from an outsider, it seems more important for South Africans when the rugby team is doing well, that it really unites your whole country, really, Peter. And I remember there's a famous picture I only saw online a couple of days ago of the one where Nelson Mandela is shaking Francois Pienaar's hand before he hands him over the World Cup. And you were probably only a young boy when they won that competition. But for you to go on a journey and win it yourself, just how much did that mean for South Africans and to you?
Yeah, I must say, for me personally, it means a lot. And I know it won't change a lot of things in the country, but just as a sportsman, you've got that dream and that hope that something will change for the better. And you will probably give someone else hope as well and opportunity to go where we were in winning the World Cup. And like you said, now I was a young boy and I looked up to those guys, and there definitely was someone that was a young boy when he won the World Cup in 2019, and probably going to say in 12 years' time, listen, those guys motivated me and helped me where I am today. And that's probably all you want, is giving people the opportunity and the belief that's possible to do what we did, and just believe. And that's the main thing for us in South Africa we want to get across.
There are some phenomenal pictures and moments of the homecoming and the weeks around arriving back to South Africa with the World Cup and the celebrations around that. Was there any standout moment from those weeks that you look back on now and think, my God, that was amazing, and I'll never forget a moment like that?
Yeah, the whole trip, the whole, I think it was a 3 or 4 day trip around South Africa. The amount of people we saw, the places we saw was eye-opening, and I couldn't believe the support we had. And I promise you, there was a lot of guys that didn't even know who the Springboks were, but they were standing next to the road and cheering us on. It was crazy, and it's probably something I'll never see in my life again, and that's something I'm very, very thankful for. And like I said, it was a really eye-opener for me to see what some good stuff can do in South Africa, even if it was for one day. Everyone was happy for one day, and really enjoyed the whole setup and everything we did.
People always talk about the supporters of the South African rugby team and how, like, yes, that's very exciting, it brings people together. But I think that's probably the main element of that. If the Lions tour went somewhere else, that would be the main thing that would be missing, would be the really passionate fans, the people that you saw on those trips, on the homecomings, on the buses around the country. That would be the key thing that would be missing from a Lions tour in South Africa if it was to be moved.
Yes, definitely. That's going to play a massive role for us. We always want our families close with us and all our friends. And it's a talking point since after the World Cup is Springboks against the Lions. Everyone bought tickets, and everyone was so cross when they didn't get tickets. So, yeah, I must say it's going to be a very sad thing when it gets moved to someplace else or have to play with empty stadiums. But like you said, the support in South Africa is unbelievable, and the people here just get crazy behind the Springboks. And of course, they'll always host the Lions with all respect and so on that they can do as well.
You were on such a high in the 2019 World Cup, but how disappointing is it to not have played a test match since then?
Yeah, so it's definitely going to be a challenge as well. But like I said, we've got to prepare ourselves mentally. I think mentally is going to be the main focus for us, just to get that behind. And the training minutes, we'll try and implement everything we can. And I know the coaches will definitely do their research and homework on what we can do and cannot do. So we'll definitely try and play to our strengths again, and that will definitely try and help us. I think they try and organize some warm-up games as well. And with rugby in South Africa started, I think, 2 weeks ago, things are looking a bit better at the moment this side as well. So we'll definitely be ready for that. And that's the one thing for the Springboks. So always, when you put that jersey over your head, it doesn't matter if you played a year ago or 2 weeks ago, you'll be ready to play for them.
And has there been many preparations yet so far ahead of the Lions tour, or have the South African team come together for training camps yet, or are you still just busy with club?
Yeah, so we're just busy with club at the moment. I think it's, like I said, it's so difficult for us, or for them as well, to confirm something, because nothing has been confirmed, because you can just go into a third wave of COVID again, and everything can go into lockdown, or the whole country and the world can go into lockdown again. So for us, I must say, for us, it's very uncertain at the moment about everything going on, and we'll probably just take it day by day, and when we have some new news, and so we'll definitely prepare according to that. But yeah, like I said, it's difficult to prepare, and even if you don't know what's going on, what the plans are going forward.
Which players, Peter, just speaking of the Lions tour, which players from this side of the world would kind of be standouts for you if they're fit to tour? Which guys have you been keeping an eye on, are you been impressed by?
In the South African setup?
No, sorry, I'm talking about in England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. So Any players that you'd be aware of coming down here?
We spoke about it a while ago, and I think it was just after the World Cup. We just won it, and it wasn't long afterwards, and I think someone said, listen, a lot of these English guys are going to be in the Lions tour side as well, and they're going to be definitely be motivated a lot, and they're definitely going to try and prove something and get us. So I guess all the guys that side will definitely be a challenge to watch out for. And that's a problem these days as well. You can't pinpoint someone. In these international setups, everyone is so extremely fit and strong and well-trained and drilled. It's difficult to say, listen, you've got to watch out for this guy. He's going to be a game breaker or so. It's the whole setup. And if you look at the northern teams as well, they're extremely well-coached and drilled. And that's what makes it always so difficult to play against them. And of course, you need to win. And like I said, it's not easy.
No, it definitely isn't easy. And Warren Gatland won't have an easy decision either in picking that team. Peter, you turned down advances from Montpellier last year to sign on with the Stormers again. Were you all excited about the prospect of playing in the Rainbow Cup that's upcoming very soon, hopefully?
Yeah, so that's something... I thought I can't say it's a good decision, because we haven't played there and we haven't seen what the schedules are like or what's going to go, but definitely a big advantage for us will be the jet lag and the travel time. It won't be a 36-hour travel to New Zealand anymore. It will be an overnight flight to the UK, and you'll definitely be ready the next day to play there as well. So that's going to have a massive impact for us and recovery as well. So I can't wait for that competition to start and see how it's gonna play out, especially in normal circumstances when everything goes back to normal. So it's something, and of course, personally for me, I like the UK and the rugby they play. That side feels to be a bit more towards our strengths. But yeah, like I said, it's difficult to say when we don't know what's going on at the moment.
I suppose when the Rainbow Cup got announced initially, I suppose the main thing, obviously, it's great that we get to play South African teams and really high quality rugby and more games, essentially. But the main thing then was, if the Lions tour went ahead, that the teams would be missing their internationals then, or the British and Irish Lions players. And obviously the main South African teams will be missing some of the Springboks. Do you see that as an issue?
No, I won't see it as an issue. I think the more game time everyone gets, probably be the better. And especially for us in South Africa, like, you know, we haven't played a lot, and especially internationally and with the overseas guys. So it's in South Africa, when we play against each other, it's always local derbies, and yeah, it's quite physical. And when you go play overseas, you definitely have to be a bit more awake on certain stuff, and it's a bit more faster game and tactical game. So you have to definitely think a bit more as well. So it's gonna be a nice challenge for us.
Absolutely. Could you ever see yourself joining the likes of Damien Dialende and Orgie Snyman coming to Munster?
Say again?
Would you ever see yourself joining the likes of Damien Dialende and Orgie Snyman in coming to Munster and moving over this side of the world?
Yeah, like I said, for me at the moment, my main thing is just to get back in the rugby field. It's been a tough road for me this last year. Last week, Monday, was exactly 1 year ago since I had my first operation, and it was exactly a year ago since I fully started training with the team. So for me, at the moment, I'm just focusing on day by day, training by training, and see how it goes. But like I said, at the moment, I'm just really enjoying it a lot.
To be honest, I get the feeling, Peter, that you'd fit in a lot better in Leinster from chatting to you here. So keep that in mind.
Of course you'd say that, Ferg.
I spoke to Marcel and he enjoyed his time there. And yeah, I know a lot of the South African guys are really loving Ireland. And I spoke to someone there that went there on holiday as well. So the times we went to Ireland, I must say, I really enjoyed it, and the hospitality we got there and the people. And of course, the Guinness beer is always nice.
Look, Peter, you'd be welcome anywhere over here. Best of luck with the rehab, and I really hope it goes well and see you back on the field really soon. Thank you so much, Peter Steph Dutoit. It has been a pleasure in having you on today.
Thank you very much. It was a real honour and a pleasure to chat with you guys.
House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe. Game changed.
On Tuesday, unfortunately, it was announced that the 2021 Women's World Cup in New Zealand is going to be postponed until 2022. Very disappointing, Emer, but how did you guys find out about it in the Ireland women's squad?
Yeah, it kind of came last minute. I don't think anyone expected it, really, even though there is a global pandemic, but we've been given such assurance that it was going to go ahead. I was back in work this week and was actually in like a department meeting, as exciting as that sounds, and got a text to say we had a Zoom call at 6 o'clock. And it was bizarre because it was like an hour away. So last minute. So we actually had gym anyway. We're gym and out in the HPC at 6 o'clock. So we were just told to wait in our cars. Obviously, we're not allowed to congregate and have meetings inside. So we were all in our cars on the Zoom call. And then we were getting ready for the meeting. And unfortunately, a link on Twitter had actually come up through Scrum Queens about the French rugby had put something up about it. So we had already found out through on social media before. Like, obviously,
that's pretty bad. Like,
it's just, I suppose, timing really. And I think the official announcement was going out at just after 6 o'clock. So we were, the plan was obviously to tell us beforehand, but it so there's always some sort of a leak, isn't there, somewhere. So I think we were all speculating what it might be. You know, obviously, was it going to be a 14-day quarantine after a World Cup qualifier against Spain next weekend? Was it that game against Spain was going to be off? But I don't think we actually expected it to be the World Cup was postponed, just because, I suppose, given any country in the world, you think New Zealand would be able to handle it with how good they've been doing in the COVID situation and how they've managed to run so many successful rugby competitions at the moment. It is very disappointing, but like, you can completely understand that the world we're in at the moment, it's asking a lot of amateur players essentially to go for a 2 weeks quarantine prior to a competition and then play whatever 4 to 6 weeks of a competition. And at the end of the day, we are amateur. It's a lot of time off, and it isn't really ideal preparation for such a big tournament to be in potentially a hotel room for 2 weeks.
Yeah, you're amateur, but at the same time, I don't think people realise, like, before I got to know you from doing this show, like, I was probably naive, you know, in thinking just how much the Irish women's team have to give up to and sacrifice to do all the training, you know, work-life, you know, balance, all of those things. Can you kind of explain, you know, the implications it had for you, for instance? I know you're trying to plan for a wedding and other women in the team have lots of stuff going on. Just what is that like for you guys?
Yeah, like, I suppose it's full time. The fact that we obviously work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, or, you know, people who work other hours, and every weekend, like, we're in at 5 o'clock on a Friday. We do a double session Friday, double session Saturday, double session Sunday. I come here, I go to work tomorrow, and I do it all over again. And it's the constant busy routine of it. But like, it's great to be busy, and obviously delighted to still be able to train at the moment when so many teams aren't allowed to train. I think when you do feel a little bit hard done by about the, you know, the World Cup postponement here, well, one, we hadn't actually qualified yet. You know, we were still in the process of qualifying. So our situation still doesn't change. We're still in the process of qualifying for the World Cup. But yes, there is huge sacrifices. Like, and I know personally, we changed our wedding because when the schedule came out, we were flying on the day of our wedding. And I just said to Dean, I was like, look, I'll be on a plane that day. Like, we can't have a wedding that day. Thankfully, he was understanding, and we moved our wedding. But again, still, it's like, God, when will the qualifiers be now? When will the World Cup be? Will it get in the way of our wedding? So like, that's just me personally, but every single person across the team has made sacrifices, and it's asking a lot for another 18 months to commit. And I think something that the women's game doesn't have, that maybe you as a player would have kind of worried about, was, you know, starting families. Essentially, you're missing a year of your life. And like, I don't know the girls' situations on the team, but a lot of people will put off now having a family because, well, it's 12 months out. Like, it's 9 months having a baby, but it's, you know, you're not going to come back after 9 months. And it's not just in Ireland. Like, women across the world who are involved in an Olympic sport or involved in the Rugby World Cup in 2022 now, like, they'll have to rethink everything about their lives, because at the end of the day, you know, we need to get time off from our employers. We need to get time off college and study. And like, even the last few weeks, we've been stressing over, do we have to quarantine when we go to Spain and play those qualifiers? And I'd had to have a chat with my principal. Thankfully, they're understanding as well, and they really support my rugby journey. But there's a lot of employers that don't support our rugby journeys, and we were going to have to quarantine on coming back from Spain, which is, you know, time off your jobs. And it causes so much stress, you know, and about having to get the time off and make up the time again, or you're using your holidays to play in a World Cup, and you're using your annual leave to play in a World Cup, and financially you're losing out then as well. So yes, there is a lot of sacrifices, but you know, we're willing to do them, but I just don't think a lot of people are aware of the amount of sacrifices that we make to play the sport.
No, of course. And then when you throw COVID in the mix, it just makes things so much more complicated, because we had Bristol and Wales flanker Elisa Butchers going onto social media on Friday with the link of a GoFundMe page ahead of her ankle surgery. So Bristol chipped in for some of the cost for Alicia, but as a Premiership player, she had to put up a GoFundMe page for to gather the money for that. Like, that's pretty crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, it really is. I suppose for a man, it probably isn't something that you think about. Most of your costs will probably get covered. But I think Bristol they're paying for some of it, but she just is obviously out of work. She, with the injury, I think she works in coaching, so she won't be able to work. She has no income, and I suppose that's another element of playing the game as well, that at the end of the day, you know, it isn't our full-time job, but sometimes it affects our full-time jobs, like I said. So it is unfortunate, and hopefully, I think actually she has raised the money and successfully done so, and the rugby community are amazing, and it just shows, you know, when people are in need like that, that they do come together. But I suppose it's something that shouldn't happen to a person who is playing professionally in the Premiership and also for her country. Have you ever had, I suppose, an injury and actually worried about it, that it was going to affect your like long-term career?
Yeah, I suppose, like, when you were talking to me about Elisa Butcher's situation there before we came on air, I couldn't believe it, because I hadn't actually heard about it. But for me personally, when I was playing, I had some bad injuries, but there was one, we were playing Munster in the Aviva a good few years ago. It was when Leo and Gervin Dempsey were the coaches, and I injured my leg, but the way I got it caught, someone landed on top of it and I got cleaned out over it. So it was quite similar to what John de Villiers did to his knee. Playing for Munster, I think. Oh, sorry, he was playing for South Africa, where he really badly did his knee ligaments. So I thought I'd broken my leg on the pitch. It was excruciatingly sore, and went off on a stretcher. But I remember thinking, lying on the stretcher, I was just worried, going, have I renewed my policy, my insurance policy? Because I didn't know. I was like, this feels that bad that my career could be over. That's genuinely what was going through my head on the stretcher, which is, no, people probably don't think that would be running through your head, but I suppose when, you know, as rugby players, you've got, you know, financial commitments, you know, between mortgages and different things like that. So, yeah, that was a pretty worrying one for me. Thankfully, I did. And I managed to get back from the injury. It wasn't as bad as expected, but I tore all the ligaments in my knee and my ankle, a very bad injury, but they're the kind of headaches that professional players have as well, you know, because the injury side of it is so attritional these days. You know, you are going to pick up some really bad injuries throughout your career, and you just have to set yourself up outside of that to make sure you're not exposed.
Yeah, and I suppose some good news coming from the IRFU in the past few weeks is that they have announced some central contracts, so thankfully they will be, you know, be able to breathe for another few years. So Ian Henderson has signed a 2-year contract, Keane Healy with the 1 year, Johnny Sexton with the 1 year, Peter O'Mahony a 2-year contract. But there's still no news on the central contract extensions for Tadhg Furlong, CJ Stander or Keith Earls. Jack McGrath's one actually expires this summer. How does that whole process work? Is it a really stressful time for players?
It would be stressful time, I'd say, particularly at the moment with COVID, it would be even more stressful. Yeah, I remember some years for me, it wasn't stressful because I was playing well and I was in the team and I was young enough. And then other times when I probably wasn't playing as well and maybe I was a little bit older and I was questioning, you know, whether I was going to be kept on and what money it was going to be for. So it can be stressful because it goes on for a number of months. And I think I had mentioned this on one of the other shows that, you know, people that have a job in the corporate world or whoever else they work, I'm sure they might sign a contract and it's just on a given day and that's it. Whereas with the, it's very fluid what happens in for rugby contracts, because it can happen any time really, from August, September, maybe to January. Like some of the last players are getting signed up in February, and that's even been pushed out later because of COVID at the moment. So yeah, I've heard that some guys still aren't sorted yet, which is tough because you're playing through half a season, and your contract might be finishing in June, and you still haven't secured what you're doing for the following year financially. And I hope those guys do get sorted, and I hope the best players stay in the country, because they're going to be really important for the growth under Andy Farrell going into that World Cup in 2023.
So in relation to the central contracts, they have been reduced from 25 to 14 in the past 4 years. What extra do those central contracts give the players? Not in terms of money. I don't want to know money exactly, but you know.
Well, you're asking the wrong man, because I was never on one. I was always contracted with Leinster. Well, I think the reality is the difference is monetary. So it's the amount that those pool of guys that are contracted under the IRFU are the highest paid players in the country. But the kind of bonus for those guys is they're probably managed more closely as well with their game time. So if you see the likes of Johnny Sexton, you know, even if he's available, he probably doesn't play, you know, every single game he could with Leinster, because that's being managed by the Irish setup. So that would probably be the perks, but really it's the money. You're paid more if you're contracted.
Do you think it makes sense to have that differentiation, or should everyone just be on a Munster contract or a Connacht contract or the provincial ones?
Well, I think it's a control thing. So if you've got, you know, your I don't know how many there is now. There used to be a few more of them, but say if you've got your eight guys that you know are going to be starting in the Irish team, you know, if they're fully fit, they're going to be playing in the side. So the likes of Andy Farrell and the coaching ticket in Ireland, they want to have more control over those players so that they're coming in, you know, fully fit and fully fresh for, you know, the biggest part of what they see is the season for them, because the Six Nations is, you know, is pivotal for them. So if they have those eight guys they're controlling that they know they're going to start in the best shape possible, then that's the reason they're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's it for today. Cheers to Peter for joining us, and cheers to everybody for watching and listening again this week. A big thank you to producer Pat, Paul, Dermot, Anthony, and everyone that helped in getting this show together. This has been House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe. Slán go fóill.
House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe. Game changed.